Hey, hello everybody. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Conrad Brogues. Thank you for being here with me today. And I have a very special guest with me today, my friend Vinny Eastwood. Vinny, say hi to the people, man.
Hi to the people. I remember that
Well, I'd ask
one
you.
time my girlfriend said to me, you know, baby, can you go out to the lounge and yell out what the time is? And I walked out into the yell lounge and went, what the time is?
What the time is, and I'd ask you how you are, but I think you'd say something like, you know, you're somewhere between fine and completely losing it, nine and a half out of ten, or how would you say you are, man?
I would probably say maybe. How do I answer that correctly? I'd probably say maybe 1.2 out of 10. You know, it's pretty bad, but it could be worse.
Well, there you go. Could be worse. You are still, of course, a man who is they're trying to put you in jail for peaceful assembly and completely non-disruptive assembly and speech, right?
Oh, yeah. We are waiting on the outcome of that trial at the moment. And it was supposed to be on the 10th of October, and it's been a long time since that already, and I'm still struggling with it, you know, kind of thing. It's just taken forever.
Yeah, it seems like they don't want to give you a quick or easy end to that one.
Yeah, I mean, which is, if this was porn, you know, that'd be a great idea, but that it's yeah, it's pretty average.
Average is one way to put it, you know. Another way to put it would be traumatic as hell.
Yeah, I've been on the edge quite a bit. Rage and depression kind of take over from time to time. So it's difficult to remain lucid, I think would be the operative term here. Because when stress and anxiety is affecting your brain, it deactivates your neocortex, your primate brain, which does all your thinking. And so if you can't think, I mean, how are you going to create? You know, I mean, my job is editing and making things that don't exist, and I can't do it. You know, the concentration is just not there. So yeah, it's been a struggle just even to do the show once a week for an hour. And an even bigger struggle to actually archive that show, which takes another hour. Like, that's a big week's work for me. It's so hard. And there's all these other things that are going on that I'm doing that aren't show-related in the right background, as well as dealing with all this court case and band broke up over COVID and so many of those things that you would consider to, you know, be your support pillars in your life have all kind of gone World Trade Center 7 on me in the last few years. So where once I had an audience and a career and an income, I've now been deplatformed and lost all my content. But I did get a message from Kelso today, Dave Kelso over at PSEC, Paradigm Shift in Educational Comedy, and he said that one time he downloaded nearly 300 gigs of my old shows off of YouTube, and he's setting up a transfer thing over the next month to be able to get those to me. And so that's great. I haven't lost absolutely everything, just most things. And this is a problem when you're dealing with the consumption of truth. In 1984, this main character worked at the Ministry of Truth, and his job was just to find articles and words and things of that nature that didn't suit the narrative of the totalitarian government and cut them out of the papers and send them down the memory hole, which incinerated them so that nobody would remember how things actually were. And so you could control the narrative of everybody forever. Now, I remember talking to a cop about 1984, and he says, oh, well, he was a little bit off, wasn't he? And it's just like, I didn't know this at the time, but I know this now, that 1984 was written in 1948. Okay, he just switched the numbers around. What he was saying was an allegory for everything that was happening right then in his time.
Yeah, you know, you were talking to a caller, I believe it was your last show, and you just said something now, thinking about the memory hole, talking about the memory hole, how things used to be, and you asked the caller if he feels, I think it was a sense of loss over how easy it was to find information back in the day. I was just listening to that, and you know, me, I don't even remember those times, you know, but it is a scary thought to that it used to be just be one way and it'll never be that way again. And now we have, you know, 2023. And if you wrote 2032 today, what would things be like in 10 years? Will you even be able to find this show or those 300 gigs that you were talking about, you know?
Would we even be able to transfer them? Would we even be able to purchase an internet account because our account or government's, shall we say, identification has been flagged as a person that's too dangerous to be able to have access to the internet, or too dangerous to be able to have access to money? Too dangerous to be able to live in shelter, right? Too dangerous to be allowed to buy food, right? So is that going to happen in the next 10 years? I don't think so. However, things like that will be happening over the next 10 years. And by the time 2099, at the end of Agenda 21, that's for the 21st century, all things that we value and love about truth, there won't be any truth anymore. Freedom, there won't be any freedom anymore. Love, there won't be any love anymore. People will have a pharmacological method by which to rather enjoy their servitude. So this is what I talk about, post-truth traumatic stress, to come from the belief that the world is all sunshine, rainbows, and sugar-coated cupcakes, to the realization that it's actually closer to a high-tech police state run by child trafficking Satanists. It can be a little bit traumatic, because whoever you were before you learned the truth, whatever your understanding of yourself was, is simply no longer the case. And you sort of have to start from scratch, as it were. You're not you anymore. You're something completely different. You're nothing. It reminds me of the movie Point Break, where John C. McGinley is marching Keanu Reeves through the police station, talking about how you kids know nothing, all right? In fact, worse than that, you know less than nothing. If you knew you knew nothing, that would be something, but you don't even know that. And to be in that kind of situation where it's like going into the military, where they break you down and they abuse you, they traumatize you, they make you do mindless, repetitive tasks, they've got fluorescent lighting, they sleep deprive you, there's a central authority that can't be questioned, the nutrition is very poor, and everybody who speaks out of turn and doesn't toe the line will get henpecked, as it were, by your fellow soldiers. Now, these precise same techniques, if you stretch them across happen to you in schooling, generally speaking, unless of course you went to one of them fancy non-public schools or non-private schools, you know, that kind of thing, just something on the outer edge of the periphery of existence. And if you went to work in any kind of major corporation, you will notice these exact same things that are in there, and the same when you go to university. So virtually all institutions that we've become accustomed to or familiarized with use cult indoctrination techniques that are remarkably similar. Depending on the institution, they may be a bit more extreme, but they're all basically the same bag of tricks that have been working for human history, really. It's the same thing your child does to you. You get sleep deprived. You can't really get the opportunity to have a meal, and you have to do these repetitive tasks of changing nappies and things of that nature. So you become the cultist for your child. Okay? You attach yourself to them. And that's precisely what happens in these institutions to a lot of individuals. Most individuals will detach from themselves and attach their sense of identity to these institutions who dangle a prize in front of you. You're going to be a Medal of Honor recipient one day. You're going to have a high honor degree, or you're going to have the top score in the class and your qualifications, such and such and blah, blah, blah. Now, when you get the prize, on the other hand, you realize that it's pretty hollow and doesn't actually mean anything. And then they start telling you, hey, there's actually another prize over here. And if you've been thoroughly indoctrinated to make you stupid, to disable your instincts, and to endure pain for other people's benefit, you will likely chase after that new carrot and traumatize yourself even further, depending on how long you've actually been going about this. For example, I looked at the statistical data on the views of one of my videos, probably 10 times more views than I normally get on a video. This was one about Billy TK and myself being convicted of standing within 2 meters of another person and being sentenced to 3 and 4 months prison, respectively. The audience demographics were quite interesting. The ages of 0 to 16, 0% of the audience. 16 to 25, 0% of the audience. 25 to 35, 0% of the audience. 35 to 50, 30% of the audience. 50 to 65, 30% of the audience. 65 and above, 30% of the audience. Now, that seems interesting. Now, what that...
Sorry to cut you off, but that is interesting, because that's just about what mine look like. Mine, I'm 27.
Mm-hmm. And you'd be the one person on the thing that spoils the whole algorithm of this recognition. So, there's a number of reasons for this, I think. Now, I don't know for sure, but what my theory is that by the age that you've gotten out of high school, you'd be, what, 17, 18. So you've gone through cult indoctrination standard. After you get out of high school, from the ages of maybe 17 to about 25, you'd be going to some form of higher education, or you'd be getting your first job or something like that. So there's another bunch of years out of cult indoctrination. After you graduate from university or you get promoted at your job, then you go into a completely different sphere where you have to go into the full-on work mode where you're not learning. You know, you're not being prepared or anything like that. You're just doing things. And then after about maybe 10 years of doing things, this is when the age of 25 to 35 is what you might consider not only your most productive in terms of the amount of hours you can stay awake, the amount of hours you can work really hard, because you're young, you haven't gotten a toxicity buildup from all the coffee you're drinking, all the cigarettes you're smoking, and all the beer you're drinking on the weekends to help you deal with the fact that you're a slave, okay? Yeah. And your body will take all that stuff on. And about the age of 35, that's when I think a lot of people have ruminated a bit. And they think, hey, you know what? People have been dangling carrots in front of me my whole life, and I've been miserable the entire time, and none of this stuff actually makes sense. I don't feel like I've got any purpose. And then they start looking at the truth. Hey, this guy says 9/11 is an inside job. Hey, this guy says vaccines are soft-kill bioweapons. Hey, this guy says that climate change has been happening for billions of years, and that human beings are not the prime cause of it. Hey, this guy says that my birth certificate is actually a stock receipt on the New York Stock Exchange, where people can buy and sell me and everybody else as live stock, right? These things are like, whoa, to somebody who's 35 and had no previous concept that such truths could happen. All right, so what that means is, at that point, you will have the darkest realization ever. I have just spent potentially half of my lifespan learning bullshit and being indoctrinated, and I have no idea who I am, and I have no idea what's true. And that is a panic-inducing moment. You won't go through this without trauma. If you've been brought up with the truth and what have you, and I haven't necessarily met anybody who has been, because most of the time it's some kind of inciting incident that happens to you during your life that will make you question, and then maybe another inciting incident after you've denied it for a little bit will force you, basically, through lack of choice. You'll feel obligated to start looking at the truth. And at that point, you're going to go into this, what they call, rabbit hole. And the whole world becomes topsy-turvy. Now, usually you'll be doing all this learning by yourself. You won't be talking to your friends about it, because every time you do, they'll call you a conspiracy theorist, tell you to shut up, you know, or say that, hey man, just have another beer and chill out, bro, like, what's wrong with you? Which makes you even angrier, because you're already quite angry that the truth has been kept from you, and the more you discover, the angrier you get, and the more excited you get, and the more motivated you are to open your big yap and tell people about this, because you think it's important, because you think that it's going to benefit them. And then you become very depressed when you realize that they don't want to listen, that they don't want to benefit from this information, principally because they're looking at you in your, I don't know, sort of like a prepubescent psychotic state after you've had a radical realignment and a severe trauma. You can't think clearly. You can't concentrate on ordinary things. You can't read people's expressions and things like that anymore, because you're filling your head full of all this truth. Thousands and thousands of hours of documentaries and radio shows with people who are way smarter than you, who are talking about stuff that you don't even understand yet. And immediately after listening to it, you run out and start telling people this thing that you just learned and didn't even watch twice. And you're surprised why they don't listen to you, why they don't see you as an authority.
Which will make you even more of a social outcast, which will make you, you know, even more split from, you know, social interaction, which we need as human beings, which just piles the trauma on top of trauma, you know, like a snowball.
That's right. And I noticed after I was on my bail conditions, I wasn't allowed to leave the house for 6 weeks. And then we still had lockdowns and things of that nature on top of that. So my human interaction went to virtually zero. And when it was all over and I was actually finally able to be invited to a party of some description, it took me the first 3 to 4 hours of that party trying to be able to talk to a human being, right? Because I've been stuck in my head the whole time, not interacting with people in person. I couldn't read anybody. I couldn't understand what they were thinking or feeling based upon the expressions that they were giving to me. And this was a truther party where you should be comfortable wow. and that kind of thing. So it was a significant step back in my ability to socially interact. And I've realized lately that most people don't actually like me. Most people don't wow. actually respect me. Most people think negatively of me, of my behaviors, of the words that I use, of the actions that I take. And I'm not talking about the general public here. I'm talking about the truth movement.
Yeah, you're supposed to be your people. You know, real quick, what you described about getting out those first few hours, not being able to read facial cues, this kind of stuff. You know who that resembles? That resembles people who are in solitary confinement, like in maximum security prisons.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was in. You know, I went from 28 hours in solitary confinement in prison to 6 weeks of solitary confinement at home. Yeah. Very difficult to talk with my ex-wife, Sarah, at the time about anything. When I came out of there, you know, I remember trying to make her coffee in the morning and I was just crying at the bench. And this sort of thing, it must have been incredibly traumatic for her. And that's what people don't necessarily take into account a lot of the time, is that when a freedom fighter, for lack of a better term, gets the sharp end of the tyranny stick, it's not just them. It's all the people in their direct circle, that would be your family that you live with and partners and things of that nature, they bear the brunt of it. And then it goes out peripherally, because to see your friend being arrested, my mate Mike, when he saw it, he got depressed for like a full 3 weeks, you know, barely could leave the house. Conveniently, it was locked down, so we couldn't really do that anyway, but still. That kind of thing really hurts people. So that's the state at work. It traumatizes you with these cult indoctrination techniques, and regardless of what institution you are. And then if you realize that those institutions are really bad, they've got all sorts of other different techniques that are remarkably similar to cult indoctrination to get you back into line, because these methodologies are specifically attuned at taking away your brain's own ability to think for itself and process things by itself, right? And I wonder what the effects have been on me, because my greatest fear, I think, is that my ability to talk, my ability to understand, my ability to listen, at some point I'll become so traumatized that I won't have that ability anymore. Right, that's probably my biggest fear, because this is how I've essentially gotten my entire way through life: talk myself into things, talk myself out of things, whatever it is. And I was very close to that upon that new party that I went to. So it was kind of like, yeah, it gave me a big kick, sort of. Seeing that and seeing how it had actually affected me, and it's affected me in all sorts of different ways since then as well, that I'm still dealing with right now. And we were arrested on August the 18th, 2021. It's what now, October 2023, and we're still not got a a verdict, you know, for our case proper, right? At the Court of Appeal, they said that it would be done on the 10th of October. It's now the 25th. And what they told us was that it'll probably be done before the end of the year. And when it happens, we'll have about 24 hours notice. Okay. So again, with these traumatizing techniques, how complex post-traumatic stress happens. PTSD is when one really traumatic thing happens to you at one point. You know, you got raped, you got kidnapped, and then the attacker was gone, or you got let go, or something like that. But still very traumatic. It's going to affect you for the rest of your life. Complex post-traumatic stress is if you were kidnapped for 3 to 6 months, or 1 to 6 months, or sold into sex trafficking for 1 to 6 months. How it affects the brain is very, very different in terms of these, because somebody who's been traumatized in a very specific way, in a very specific instant, will develop what they call triggers. Okay, if they see or hear anything that's similar to that traumatizing circumstance in their real life, even if it's not a traumatizing circumstance, even if it's not a threat, their brain says that it is, and they go into these triggered panic states. Over a complex post-traumatic stress, however, it's much worse, because it means that every single day is the opportunity for more triggers to develop and become rooted in your mind. So somebody with PTSD might be walking around with one, maybe two triggers of stuff that they could see that might mess them up for the day. Somebody with CPTSD might be walking around with 10, 20, 100 different triggers for completely different things that happened to them over that period of time that they had absolutely no control over their life. So court, police, mainstream media, aggressive conversations, you know, lots of things trigger me and can, depending on the incidents, make me have a full-blown panic attack. And so I'm not the same person I once was. I'm now hypervigilant. I'm now much quicker to anger, much quicker to go into deep states of depression, much quicker to just all of a sudden, upon some piece of information being given to me, go off and cry, right? They've cut the legs off me emotionally and psychologically speaking. Now, potentially, I may have to be like this for the rest of my life, you know, people would fear and what have you, but I don't think that's the case. I think once the trauma goes away, yes, you've still got all these triggers, and you can't just get rid of them by reading a book or getting a counseling session or something of that nature. It becomes something that you actually have to work for a significant period of your life on to get rid of, right? That's what's problematic about complex post-traumatic stress and the generalized trauma that virtually everybody suffers during these institutions. They have these triggers on you, and that's why when you try to wake people up to them, you traumatize them and you trigger them. That's why you might see those responses on social media or even in real life when people get immediately very upset with, like, this came out of nowhere sort of thing. You ever had those kind of conversations where somebody gets immediately aggressive because you've told them some piece of information that they're not willing to accept, right?
Yeah, that's right. Especially in the big city like me, you'll be trying to just have a conversation, just trying to talk reasonably, and then all of a sudden it's that response like you just insulted them personally. Deep, deep personal emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm. Because their little ego, okay, which means your sense of self. If you don't have an ego, there's something wrong with you. Okay, I know this because Dr. Sam Vaknin told me that psychopaths have no ego. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, Vinny, if I insult you, call you a rude word or something like that, or tell a vicious lie about you, you'll be hurt by the fact that I've done that, because you have a sense of yourself. You know what you are and you know what you are not. And when people tell you thing that you are what you are not, what you're clearly not, you will get offended and you will get upset by it. Psychopath doesn't have that problem. You could call them any name under the sun, and it could all be true or untrue, and it could be the most abusive language you could ever conceive of, and it just right over their head, they feel nothing. Okay, that's why when you see people like Luke Rutkowski or in New Zealand John Ansell going up and ambushing these corrupt politicians and globalists and things of that nature, do they appear rattled? Or do they just kind of sit there and process how to get out of this and how to prevent you from coming at them again and how to potentially destroy you if you make them angry enough, right? It's not being done in an emotional way. They're not offended. They're not hurt. They just don't like you, and they want to do something to stop you from exposing them. So if you are go ahead.
Well, I'm sure those powerful people, you, if you're talking about the Satanists, the social engineers, they would say that that psychopathy, that ability to react to things unemotionally, would be an advantage. And I wanted to respond and go in the direction that maybe on the surface in that situation it might be an advantage, but it's actually a disadvantage, because it's really all about emotional health, your range of emotions that you can experience. This is what makes you a real able human being after you could heal the trauma. But that's why that goes back to what we were just talking about. If you don't heal, you don't have that healthy range of emotions to be able to respond to and make the most of them as tools.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Vinny.
Do they have an evolutionary advantage? Well, it depends what you're trying to evolve into. Are you trying to evolve into somebody who has more money, more power, more sex, and no spirituality, no emotion, and no true care? If that was the benchmark for what they're trying to achieve, then yes, psychopathy gives you a quote-unquote evolutionary advantage. However, if you're trying to build love, if you're trying to embody truth and facts, and you're trying to advance the human condition or the understanding of the human condition, psychopathy doesn't help you terribly much. However, what you can do as a psychopath is you can find people who do have those things that you don't and steal all their ideas, claim that they're yours, and have everybody worship you for being something that you're not, and you feel great about it because you actually believe that you are that something. Because psychopaths not only can pass lie detector tests, all right, they can even disassociate themselves from previous behavior. For example, if Conrad Rogas was a psychopath and he changed his name to Vinny Eastwood, everything that Conrad Rogas, as the psychopath, had done in his previous life, the amount of animals that he butchered as a young child, the amount of liquor store clerks that he'd shot in the face in order to get some malt liquor, like that, as soon as he changes his name to Vinny Eastwood, and somebody says, "Hey, you're Conrad Rogas. You did this. You shot my employer in the face and robbed him of his malt liquor." You can go, "No, I didn't.
No, I'm not.
That was Conrad Rogas, bro. That's not me. I'm Vinny Eastwood." You see? An absolute, complete detachment from that. And this is a confusing thing for somebody with a conscience, okay? Have you hurt somebody before? I have, and I felt really bad about it, and I apologized, and I tried to make up for it and stuff like that, and I couldn't sleep very well that night because it's tossing and turning. You know, it's guilt, right? That's a conscience. How do these people sleep at night, you hear people say. They don't have a conscience to keep them up. That's why. Okay? How can somebody do something like that? Because they don't have a conscience to restrain their actions. Okay? And that's the reason why you, and I mean you, and in general the public of this world, can't understand what they will do or why they will do it. Because you possess a conscience that disables you from even imagining what their motivations are. Okay? I've been studying psychopaths for years, and I cannot even, I still won't be able to predict their behaviors, what they'll say, or what they'll do in any given moment, because they're completely and utterly without a sense of self, and that makes them utterly, totally unpredictable. And that's what makes them so dangerous, because of their predatory mindset. How much money can I get out of this guy? How many ideas can I steal from him? How much sex can I get out of this girl before she realizes that I'm not a human being? You know, these people are out there, and they're absolutely terrifying. Just as terrifying as seeing a hungry bear right in front of you, charging after you, wanting to carve your ass up for a meal. That's really frightening. And I can assure you that psychopaths are even more terrifying, because they'll do things to you that a wild animal wouldn't in their wildest dreams conceive of doing to you.
That's right. I like how you characterize them as like an animal, as like a different species. And this is correct. And if somebody's without a self, while you were speaking, I was just thinking, yeah, this is exactly what they do, because these people who position themselves into a so-called, you know, position of authority, they can't produce much. The government doesn't produce anything. They just shave off the top and they take everything that us people do. And that must be the main thing that differentiate those two species, is that we have emotions, we have a self, and we have love, and they don't. So really, they're more of not, they're worse than a bear. It's more of a parasite, right?
People have told lots of stories over the last couple of thousand years in order to try and explain these in layman's terms. Most people have heard of a vampire. Okay, what do? They suck your blood. What is your blood? It's your life essence. It's your DNA. It's your blueprint. What a psychopath can do is they can literally suck the life out of you with their scumbaggery. And they can copy and replicate all the things that you are and pass it off perfectly. All right? How do you kill a vampire? Stake through the heart. Okay? How do you kill a psychopath? that's the thing. And why are vampires afraid of light? Okay? Light is to expose, as to use the camera terminology. And that is widely understood to be the main fear of a psychopath, is to be exposed for exactly what they are. They know that it's dangerous being a psychopath, because at any point, if you're, for example, going out to murder somebody in Washington, D.C. or Chicago, where there's a handgun ban, you know your victims aren't armed. Okay? So a psychopath, like a predator, will try and find a defenseless animal, separate it from the herd, and then leap upon it with all of their viciousness. Okay? That's why a lot of people get sucked in, because psychopaths are very charming, very enchanting when you first meet them, but ultimately shallow and have few meaningful, long-lasting relationships. They crave money and power and sex, and they're willing to do things like sabotage, manipulate, violate, steal, even kill. And they'll be able to do so without ever feeling bad about it or ever having to take responsibility for it. That is so freaking scary. And what that means is, I think, in my estimation, the reason why we tell people stories about monsters and demons is to, through allegory, let people know that these things are among us. How does the vampire get into your house to eat you? You have to invite them in.
You have to invite them in. Okay, so that they're scary, right? The monsters, the vampires. But then I think about, you know, this is an ancient plan. And these people who want basically to take all of our property and have us lived in total hardcore slavery, you know, you could kind of understand, I guess, the predator, you know, the bear, the tiger, even the vampire. That's what he feeds on. He needs it. But these people are, this is like a long-term plan of like intentional incompetence. They're like destroying our relationships so we can't even experience happiness. They're poisoning our children so we can't even have, you know, so we can't even have strong families. It's such good, just going overboard, way more than just like a simple predator. It's even more ugly that, you know.
It's terraforming. T-E-R-R-O-R forming. You see? What they're trying to do is they're trying to change the planet. And the planet's us. Like, our consciousness really kind of creates reality in a very collective manner. My desk and my chair and my computers, they all have consciousness of their own. They're all thinking and they're all sending up into the morphic field of reality what their intentions are and things of that nature. And occasionally things start to manifest. So what these people are cognizant of, especially the higher up elites and dark occultists, most of which you'll probably never meet, and you'll probably never hear their names or know them for that matter. But for all intents and purposes, if you are the king psychopath, okay, you got no conscience to restrain you from what you will do to your own children. You will traumatize your own children so that they become even meaner than you are. And you'll tell them that they're better than all of those other scum out there. And that here's all this money, son. Here, go in there. I'm going to teach you how to manipulate people. I'm going to teach you how to lie. I'm going to teach you how to steal. I'm going to teach you how to kill and get away with it so that you can continue doing it. And we're going to do it to absolutely everybody in the whole planet. This planet will be ours. We'll be able to go around doing anything we want. If we get pulled over by a cop, and we've got a hooker bound and gagged in the passenger seat and a pound of cocaine in the back seat, that cop will look at us and say, "Are you having a good night, sir? On your way." Okay? That's what we want. The ability to be utterly psychopathic without any of the cautionary principles that makes a successful psychopath. The ability to get away with things. Because they have to learn this, and they have to practice it, and they have to work very, very hard to keep themselves out of jail, to keep themselves from getting shot, to keep themselves from being sabotaged and destroyed by people who recognize what they are and don't want to work with them and don't want them around anymore. Imagine if they had an AI supercomputer to control the entirety of the population to prevent anybody from being able to do anything ever to them. So my book that I keep delaying writing, but I've gotten the first 80 pages or something of it written, as well as a skeleton [S2] All right. [S1] For how it goes, is called Ethereum. And The preamble to the book concerns the future history of mankind. that in the year 2100, a great AI supercomputer called Omnis was instituted by the global elites in order to keep mankind in a perpetual state of sustainability. Told them that they what they could do, told them what they couldn't do. And what the AI was limited from doing was telling any of the elites what to do. Okay? But it just had to keep the population sustainable. And for about 700 years, it worked like this for a long period of time where psychopaths could go and just snatch a child off the street. Nobody would be able to do anything about it. They try to intervene or something. Their chip would stop them. And everybody was living in a perpetual state of absolute terror. But the progeny of these elites, not knowing about what it meant to try and protect yourself, to conceal your psychopathy and what have you, were able to do anything that they wanted, and thus they had no restraint whatsoever, and they began to torture and kill on such a massive level. But by the year 2800, Omnis recognized the elites themselves as a threat to its main protocol of sustainability of the human race. They were slaughtering too many people. They had great fields of torture where screams were like flowers and pain their fragrance. Omnis decided that they needed to be wiped out, and because all of these elites were being served by AI androids and robots and things of that nature that the AI itself controlled, it didn't find it that difficult. It managed to slaughter them all, the whole solar system wide. Cleansed it in 43 minutes. Then the elites, some of them, one family in particular, did not trust the AI from the outset and had installed a kill switch so that if it did ever come after them, that AI would be disabled. And they did manage to get the kill switch clicked off. So at that point in humanity's history, they suddenly had no elites and no machines controlling the vast majority of mankind anymore. And the whole human race erupted in this gargantuan celebration. People were playing music and dancing in the streets and painting the walls of office buildings and all this art, all this invention, and things that people had had to keep to themselves for their entire lives, many of which generation after generation had passed down ideas and thoughts and instruments that had been kept hidden and concealed. And this celebration evolved this community spirit where everybody suddenly knew that it was wrong to control everybody, that it was definitely wrong to torture anybody, and it was certainly wrong to stop people from experimenting and expressing themselves. And the human race created a protectorate, which meant that the only force of institution where anybody could have any of their God-given rights taken away from them was if they were taking those rights from somebody else first. The protectorate was very successful. It made a lot of money, and technology started to develop very, very fast, far beyond what anybody would really conceive at the time. Approximately 300 years later, in the year 3100, Guy created what he called the quantum diaspora drive, which was able to replicate the resonant frequency of one space and get it to translate to another. What that meant was they were able to encase spaceships in a field and then pick a point in space that they would immediately shift to. They saved so much time and so much energy from doing this that it completely revolutionized the ability for trade and, in particular, migration. Generally, you can't go to an area unless there's, you know, a supermarket or something of that nature. How are you going to survive wherever you go? And at this point, they had made distance mean nothing. So if your nearest supermarket is 200 billion light years away and you can get there in a second, that means that you could colonize anything, anywhere. And one guy had the crazy idea to try and jump to an adjacent galaxy and return safely, and he was successful. And in the time set in the story, it's the year 4092, and humanity and this protectorate had expanded across six galaxies, and they're now just prospecting the seventh for mining resources and things of that nature. But each new galaxy that humanity discovered and colonized, they found remnants of a much more ancient civilization that was there, that left monuments warning of a great beast that lurks in the dark places between the galaxies, and that it's hungry, it's coming, and there is a weapon to defeat it.
I got two thoughts. One is that I think I know the basic, I'm not going to give it away, but you know, while you were saying that, and especially there at the end, I'm like, I know what this is, and I know what, I think I know. But a second thing is, man, I didn't expect to get this, you know, preview synopsis. Is this an exclusive for here, or have you told people about what you got there?
I've told people in person. I haven't done it online yet. And that's just that's just the preamble. That's everything that happens before the story actually starts.
Oh, because then, you know, then I'll just say, because it sounds like in just different, obviously you added more to it, you did it your own way, but it's really the history of this world, right?
Yeah, it's what you might call a meta allegory.
Okay.
So that you can make one thing appear one way, and yet conceptually it's built up of these component parts, where if you're looking at it one way, it'll appear that way. But if you look at it in another way, it'll also appear that way. And if you look at it in a different way, it'll appear that way too. So I got the idea off of the director's commentary of Starship Troopers. And what was interesting is that the maker of the film, Paul Verhoeven, who's the maker of RoboCop, he said that this was a sarcastic movie that was trying to make people recognize the lack of value in totalitarianism. All right? Now, people who watch it with that lens go, whoa. But the advertising was all about this giant battle between humans and space bugs, you see?
Right.
Cleverly wrapped up, so that people who've even watched the film many, many times, it's their favorite film or whatever, have no idea what it's really about.
Yeah, it's brilliant, because when you mentioned the AI and the elites, you know, that's like the previous species, those ancient civilizations, and then humanity was left alone, right? And we made the protectorate, which is, you know, to me, that's the government, right? And then we had instant communication, we had money, and meanwhile, the great beast is coming, you know? So how do we defeat the great beast?
Well, it's kind of like a bit of a spoiler alert there. So,
well, that's right.
The very things that free humanity can also bind them, and the very things that bind them can also free them if they're reverse engineered or used with the opposite waveform. So what happens is the beast comes along across the seventh galaxy while Kemper, Frost, and Rosario are prospecting this new pyramid, and it's the oldest pyramid that they've found yet, with the clearest distinction of the prophecy. And while they're in there, it starts shaking, and they manage to only just barely escape the collapsing roof of this pyramid as they get out to their ship. And when they get into space, they realize that space is shaking. And then they see it. This giant tentacled beast, many, many, many times the size of a galaxy, gobbling up suns, hundreds of billions of them, and planets, just crushing them all into nothingness, into its giant maw. And these guys are absolutely terrified. They're in the worst shock that they could ever conceive of. There's a creature out there that can eat an entire galaxy just like that. And they manage to get away from it only barely by the skin of their teeth. And this thing has a massive gravitic pull that attracts everything to it and sucks it in. So they had to pull their drives to full power in order to escape, which is extremely dangerous. And they find out why when they appear on the other side of the reach, where the guy's face is floating off of his head a few feet from him. And he starts to freak out. He's like, oh my God! My face is off! My face is off my friend! And they go, no, bro, just take a deep breath. And you go, see, there you go, bro. You're all back together again. Full diaspora exposure. Disembodied, literally, at the point of disappearing from one reality to another, and parts of you don't catch up all at once. They find the ship that's floating out there just in the void. It was watching what this thing was doing. And on board, they couldn't find anybody alive. They just found this kind of black goo. The pilot looked like he'd exploded out in all directions, like every pore of his body had just poured forth with this kind of gooey type substance. And they suddenly hear the screaming coming from a room called the Resonating Chamber. And as they're going through to that Resonating Chamber, they see a dermatology lab. And they're like, what the hell is this ship? And this ship is really ornate. Like, it's beautifully designed. So sleek, so much craftsmanship had gone into it. It looked like the most expensive thing that they could even conceive of, with beautiful technology and wonderful looking stuff all over the place. And so when they get to the Resonating Chamber, they see this guy screaming in a space suit, and there's no oxygen in the ship. It had been depressurized. So they repressurize it, and this guy starts screaming and telling them, no, don't do that. And they hear this whale song, and that black goo that was on the ground in the no oxygen environment got up and started moving towards them, and it was incredibly strong. It broke through the bulkhead door, grabs this person, crushes their space suit visor, and puts its goo all over his face and his body and through the suit. And then this guy starts to erupt in these gargantuan blackhead-like pimple formations all over him. And he explodes in all directions, just like the pilot did. And this creature managed to grab Rosario, the junior on the crew, and is just almost crushed his visor and gotten a little bit into him before they managed to depressurize. But unfortunately, he's been infected. So they have to go to the dermatology lab, and without oxygen, he has to take his visor off. And it runs a gravity purge on his cellular structure, where it presses everything and it makes all his pores explode outwards, and it captures all this gunk and a little what would you call it, a quarantine jar. And they bring him back to life. They put his suit back on. And I say, bro, you look 20 years younger. And this ship, they have to use it because their own one's damaged to go to the sixth galaxy to warn them about what's coming. But when they get there to tell them about it, nobody believes them. And it's only once they do a demonstration out of desperation with a proto-rat, because in this universe, it's illegal to experiment on sentient life and organic and stuff like that. So they create these what you might call android animals, which have a biological system, but they don't have any of the associated soul of an animal, as it were. And they experiment on this in a big conference hall in front of people, and they show what this goo does to a living organism. And it explodes out in every direction, and everybody suddenly freaks out. And while this is happening, the stars in the sky start disappearing. Little girl's like looking up at the stars, and her dad's teaching her astronomy. And then they notice that one of the stars is missing. And then another disappears, and then another, and another, and all of a sudden hundreds of them start disappearing out of the night sky. And suddenly people all across the planet there, and across the whole galaxy there, really just start kind of like screaming, because it was terrifying. Like this giant cacophony of quadrillions of human beings, terrified screams start happening. And this galaxy gets consumed. The guys managed to escape it because they had a plan. They figured what the weapon might be. The Diaspora Drive had a weapons element to it. It could transport you to another thing. But it might, on the other hand, be able to erase what it has. And this is what happened to the fifth galaxy. There was an experiment there on the edges of the fringe, and a huge sphere of nothingness was in that galaxy. It looked like a pizza rotating with a huge bite out of it. And what these people had done is they'd managed to extend the diaspora field across a massive portion of the galaxy in order to collapse it in on itself. So instead of transporting one thing to another location, they would make both locations mash and disappear altogether. And this was a big breakthrough, but also at the same time, it was an experiment that they didn't know the cost of. And so they lost like trillions and trillions of human lives in this experiment, unwittingly, all these planets and things of that nature surrounding the blast zone. Now, right on the very edge of this is a planet called Gilgamesh. Now, unbeknownst to the heroes of the story, Gilgamesh is controlled by the elites who survived and has been for some time. And what they need to do is go to this planet, find this technology in order to be able to bring it back, find the beast and kill it. Now, unfortunately, what that means is they have to pretend like they're locals, okay? And the locals at the time have these what you call gravity leashes, where you can attach a couple of modules to your belt, and for each module you can have a slave person within your proximity, and you keep them there. And they have to, all the slaves, all of them, they have to be staring at their tablet at all times. If they look up from the tablet, they're whipped or punched or something like that. So Kemper, the leader, has Frost and Rosario, his two crewmen, in there, and they're really struggling with trying to blend in by looking at these screens the whole time. Like, they can't look up, they can't look around, they can't look anybody in the eyes and things of that nature. But they do manage to do a deal with the ruler of the planet, because this ruler of the planet not only recognizes that the diaspora technology that they've got could kill the beast, but he also has another piece of technology that's based on the same concept, but instead of affecting space, it affected time. So they've got this ship that's able to have a ring around it of what we call non-temporality. Like, it doesn't exist, right there at that time. It might be a second before, it might be a second after, but they're essentially able to phase through any point of reality just as you would by riding a bike down the street. And anything that's passing through them or passing at them doesn't affect them because they're not in the same dimension, ostensibly. They recognize that this is the ship that's going to enable them to deliver the weapon to the creature. Now, they do manage to organize a huge amount of humanity in this fight. The problem is that they recognize the thing that the creature is attracted by is the diaspora engine energy. And there's lots of navigation buoys and lighthouses that use this diaspora energy for the purposes of interstellar navigation and intergalactic navigation. So they had a choice whether or not they were going to shut down their entire civilization, their intergalactic civilization, because the one thing that they need in order to make sure everybody's got their food, got their water, and doesn't die is this diaspora device, which is the very one thing that this creature is attracted to and wants to come and eat. The thing you love, the thing you need, is the thing that spells your doom. So that choice became a massive sacrifice for many, and the plan became that they would take fleets of ships and they would try to distract the creature while this time-bending machine ship lands on its back, drills down into it, and explodes it from the inside. Just before, and in terms of galactic navigation, the Sixth Galaxy was actually physically closer to our home galaxy, where Earth is. And so that is the next target of the creature, because it has the brightest amount of diaspora lighthouses and things of that nature to attract it. And it's a terrifying ordeal. Millions of people and millions of ships trying to distract this thing and getting caught in the gravity field and getting destroyed and getting killed. All these people sacrificing themselves to save all of existence as these guys get on the back, fighting off these black goo creatures all around them with plasma flamers and all of the weapons that they've got at their disposal to keep them off their backs while they drill down. And just when it starts to enter Earth's galactic sort of atmosphere and begins to the process of starting to consume its stars and its suns and all of those things, that is when the mission ends, and these guys, seconds before death would occur, manage to explode this weapon, sacrificing themselves with it and the beast. And the Protectorate decides that in order to honor these people who sacrificed so much to save all of humanity, that they would construct giant monuments around the galactic fringe to not only remember these people, but to warn them in the future of what might come again.
Well, I kind of can't believe I just got all that. And your memory of that is pretty good. It just told that story just like that. I mean, it's no wonder. I didn't even know you were writing a book. You know, I had some more things to talk about, but I think we should end it with that. You know, I'm looking forward to, you know, to reading that. And hopefully, Vinny, you don't have to finish that book in jail. You
know? I mean, to be honest, that was one thing I was thinking to myself. Man, maybe I could finish my book in jail. I wouldn't have any other distraction.
Somebody said that to you. I don't know if it was... I remember I was watching your show and I was just like, God, man, don't say that.
hey, man, you know, what my mate DK says is that if they send me to jail, they'll be handing me an army. Because my career is built upon the disenfranchised of mankind and the things that they're really upset about and what have you. Could you consider a place with a higher concentration of disenfranchised, upset people than prison.
Huh. Yeah. Maybe the Gaza Strip, prison at a close second.
Yeah.
But
well, that's an open air prison, but I'll give you that one.
Okay. And shout out to DK, man, and all of your, you know, all of your audience. You know, you guys are great. But before I let, you know, Vinny say whatever he wants to say, I wanted to thank everybody for watching it. And thank you, Vinny, for coming by. And you've made it a very interesting evening for me. And I'm ready to watch some science fiction after all that.
Yeah. Well, if anybody is a producer or a filmmaker or something like that, this book is being written what I call not a screenplay, not a book, not a radio play, but all three of them. So that when you read it, it is being described as though the book itself could be narrated. Also, with separate dialogue where a director of a film could read it and use the descriptions in between that dialogue as a template by what the scene's going to look like and the dialogue itself for the actors themselves. So I really do think it would be probably the most epic sci-fi film ever made if it was done really well. And the reason I think of this is because everybody's seen the end of the world in a movie. Everybody. You know, and up until the point of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we're now talking about the destructions of entire galaxies. And I was thinking, well, we're going to think about upping our game here. What's even bigger than one galaxy potentially being destroyed? Half a dozen fully populated ones full of these really spiritual, really cool, very family-orientated people who live in a peace-loving protectorate. The loss of that is something so visceral in scale that it basically staggers people. It blows them away. And that's what you really need to do sometimes when the image is not big enough. Just blow it up a little bit and you'll have the effect that is desired. And with that, it's a wonderful pleasure to have been speaking to you, Conrad, and to your audience as well. Thank you guys so much for listening to my random ramblings. But I hope that some of you might have taken something away from this, something that'll help you get through tomorrow, because tomorrow never comes. It's always approaching, but it never comes, because as soon as tomorrow gets here, it's always today, isn't it? And so you've got to enjoy today and look forward to tomorrow, even though it's a place you'll never get to. Just like you should focus on trying to perfect yourself, knowing that you'll never actually achieve it. That's the noble pursuit of time and work that we all engage in if we want to think of our lives as having a purpose worth living for.
Beautiful, Vinny, amazing as always. And I hope you do get that help you need and make that best science fiction movie ever. Epic.
Mm-mm-mm. Big ol'
epic. Awesome, man.
Cheers, brother. Thank you so much, everybody. And we'll see you again sometime at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. So with that being said, ladies, gentlemen, hermaphrodites, thank you very much for listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show, which is just bad news. Like the news, but worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child-trafficking Satanists is Vinny's jokes.
Cheers, Vinny.
Thanks, bro.